Well, every once in a while in the news we hear of an individual who's found to be a hoarder. In fact, on cable television there used to be a show about that. But someone, for instance, that might have, say, 70 cats in their house, or the house is so full of items that the only way to move through the house is by paths in each room. I personally knew such an individual, the latter of those two examples. In fact, he had so much in his house, the house was literally sagging from the weight of everything in it. Oftentimes, though, with those types of individuals, there's some sort of mental or physical trauma that can add or contribute to this hoarding. But even if we're not that type of hoarder, we find comfort in being able to say, I have a lot of stuff, but not like that person. But that's not what we're comparing ourselves to, is it? Human beings always love to be justified in their own actions. We compare ourselves amongst ourselves. We look at someone that perhaps is on the extreme edge, and we're glad that we're not like that. But if you don't think that you have a lot of stuff, just move and find out how much stuff you have when you have to pack it all up and you have to transport it to someplace different. We collect things, don't we? Even if we're not moving, we can collect clothes, we can collect books or toys. It doesn't matter if you're a big boy or a little boy, we still collect toys. Paraphernalia for hobbies, writing pens can accumulate. I don't know where all those pens come from, but it just seems like I'm always tossing pens away. We could add to that list, depending on who we are and what our hobbies are, what kind of background we have. We like to collect things. Some of these things we find useful. Maybe they were useful for a time, and maybe they're not now, but they can become so much baggage if we're not careful that we just continually pull forward with us in life, even if it's not a collection of 70 cats or a house that's too full of things. Just this past week, in doing some of the spring cleaning prior to Unleavened Bread, I decided to go through my bookshelves. There were a number of things that I'd still had from even going back to my Ambassador College days, and I realized, you know what, I have all this electronically. I don't need these physical binders, and it freed up so much space. But that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about here. This concept of spiritual baggage, though, is really what I'm getting to. It can seem rather antiquated to many people to consider this, especially those that have turned away from God's word or not even familiar with it to begin with, but live according to their own level of righteousness. This has been the predominant view since the Garden of Eden, isn't it? That we decide we know better than God and we decide what is of value. But for those who appreciate that God seeks for mankind to understand the ramifications of sin, it has always been the focus of analyzing the spiritual baggage we are to shed. This is the examining that Paul talks about. This is the review that we're to do on a regular basis in our lives to consider where we are and where we stand before God. The Apostle Paul talked about this shedding of the weight of sin. We'll read that verse here in a moment. But before I get to that, I wanted to summarize a story that had a big impact on me when I took my American literature class in college. I think of this story from time to time because it had such an impact on me. And this story created quite a stir when it was first published back in 1854. The story I'm referring to is called The Celestial Railroad. It was written by Nathaniel Hawthorne. He wrote it in response to another story that was written. I won't get into that aspect of it. But in Hawthorne's account, he ridiculed the easy way of life promoted by the liberal thinkers of his day. That might sound odd to our ear. We think of the 1800s, especially around the time of the Civil War, of being a time of great religious fervor. And for some it was, but it was already beginning to change way back then and how people viewed God and what was required of them. Can you imagine what Hawthorne would think if he was suddenly alive today and looked at the world that has become? In Hawthorne's story, going back to that, he was building off of the allegorical tale written by John Bunyan. That piece was called Pilgrim's Progress, and it had quite an impact as well. In Bunyan's tale, he described life as a hard journey. Bunyan was a Puritan, so that was their viewpoint. But Hawthorne was reacting, in addition to Bunyan's piece, he was reacting to the transcendentalists and the liberal Unitarians of his day. They had a completely disconnected view from God. They might look at moral righteousness, they might look at truth in a universal scale, but they didn't consider God in a personal relationship with laws and requirements for character. And so Hawthorne was warning against the moral decline that he saw even in his day. So Hawthorne lays out this tale as a choice. It's called The Celestial Railroad, and how he frames this is that this individual is taking a journey to heaven. The Celestial Railroad is going to heaven. And so there are two choices. There are two paths to get to the Celestial City. One is by foot, following this path, and it's a harder way to go. It ups and downs, and there are different things I'll come to in a moment that you have to go through. The other option is simply take your baggage, get on the railroad, and ride the ride. You didn't have to do anything. It was comfortable. At the culmination of that journey, both actually, would be the Celestial City, hence the name of his piece. In Hawthorne's allegorical tale, the pilgrim in this story starts out the journey with his load of sins pictured by the baggage, and he's at the rail station. He gets on the train, and he sees all this from a distance. As the travel begins, the train leaves from the city of destruction and is headed towards the Celestial City on the railroad. But along the way, they pass the Slough of Despond, the Wicked Gate, the Hill of Difficulty, and many other places. He and the other travelers on the train see the fiend Apollyon in the Valley of Humiliation. And from a distance, they see the Valley of the Shadow of Death, the City of Vanity Fair, the Delectable Mountains, and the River of Death. All of this while he's comfortably riding on this railroad. At the end of the journey, the pilgrim realizes that the easy way, riding the train, thwarted him from reaching the goal. He doesn't get into the Celestial City because the railroad stops short of it, and there's a large chasm between the end of the railhead and the Celestial City that he can't cross. Taking the train so he could bring along all of his baggage gained him nothing in the end. The realization is all the more painful because he sees two travelers who took the difficult pathway and whom they'd actually seen struggling at various times along the trip. And because they were not weighed down with the heavy baggage, they were able to make it into the Celestial City. Now, we would disagree with the underlying theology of Nathaniel Hawthorne's story, but I've always appreciated the principle he was advocating. He was advocating not a hard way, but a way requiring sacrifice. There's value in considering this aspect of lightening our spiritual load from the baggage of sin we collect in order to make our journey more profitable now and to reach the destination we're headed towards. So the title of my message today is simply Spiritual Baggage. This is just one time a year when we take a stop, if you will, and look and analyze what we're carrying with us through life. But this is by no means the only time we should do this. It's just more pertinent right now. And to discuss this topic, then, I have three aspects of the spiritual baggage that we should lay aside. So the first of them is wrong thoughts. Number one, wrong thoughts. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 12. I believe the Apostle Paul wrote this book. That's a separate discussion for another time, but nonetheless, the writer here in chapter 11 that we're most familiar with rehearses aspects of faith and individuals who pictured that very succinctly in their lives as they followed God's instruction. And so then in the beginning of chapter 12, he summarizes this a little bit as he begins. He says, "Therefore, in light of those examples, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses that you and I understand and know and should see what those individuals went through in life, how God worked with them, what they sacrificed for what God was offering, this cloud of witnesses, since that's there," he says, "let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Think back to when you were first exposed to God's truth. Wasn't it easy at first to spot the obvious sins we needed to put away? It might have even been painful upon recognition of what those sins were. But we learned about the Sabbath. We learned the holy days, the tithing, the food laws, and so much more. And then we move on, don't we, to less concrete characteristics like mercy and brotherly love and true service, outgoing concern. Those become something we have to internalize in our character, doesn't it? We turn more from a get way of life to a give way of life. Let me read you part of this verse from the NIV. It says, "Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles." You know, if you're going to run a race, you watch modern athletes. In fact, there's a huge science now just in the shoes. And the governing bodies have to recognize what's legal in their terms, what's legal and not legal, because there's materials and technologies available that can actually help individuals run faster. But the goal is to be as light as possible, to be as fast as possible in that pursuit of winning a race. It's not so different from us. What hinders us in our walk? What is something that will entangle us? It's absolutely necessary to grow in God's truth. And sometimes we can think that's the end goal, but that's the process by which we get to where God is asking us to be, what he is offering for us to have. If we simply focus on God's truth, it would be like painting over a water-damaged wall. It looks good for a time, like the problem has been fixed, but it's only temporary, isn't it? It doesn't address the underlying issue. We must remove sin when we see it. That's what we focus on this time of year especially, to remove sin when we see it, the weight of sin that holds us back and slows us down in learning and growing to become a son or a daughter of God. This is what the world doesn't see, right? The world goes on about its business. It's just life, whatever life they have. They don't see a purpose and a goal towards something that's being offered. But sin indeed hinders and entangles us. We look at the world around us. Part of this current crisis we're facing with this COVID virus is that we've gotten used in the last especially 60 or 70 years, but even going back to 100 years or so, we can solve these problems, can't we? Vaccines and health laws that are all good and fine, but what's the missing component of what mankind addresses in all of this? What we should do before God. He promised Israel he would protect them from diseases and so forth. It's really no different in other aspects of our life. He promises to bless us when we follow his law. But again, back to the point, when we see sin in our life, we must remove it because it does hinder and entangle us. And let's look at that in 1 John chapter 2. Again, we're in this world, and it's easy to see these advances that mankind has made, and we can marvel at it, can't we? You know, the flight times, part of the current crisis again right now is because we have such amazing technology to move around the world now, where this might not have been an issue 200 years ago. But we look at what mankind has achieved, the technology. Look at how we're doing this today. Who would have dreamed even 10 years ago we could pull something like this off on a Sabbath day to still be connected by this technology? We marvel at that, but what we don't think oftentimes is, what would be possible if all of mankind truly followed God's law? I think that's going to be one of the more astounding things we see in the millennium, but I'm getting ahead of the story here. But 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, John here sets a reality, sets a stage here for how we should be reminded of how to view things. He says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world." Now, that love is in context of what we pursue. Don't pursue the things in the world. He says, if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Why is that? Because the world has not built itself on the foundation of God's truth. It's built itself on the foundation of what Satan has promoted, on mankind's carnality. So we have greed, we have competition, we have strife, we have envy, we have wars. All of these things that we've become accustomed to and have tolerated. But that's the world. It's not God's. Verse 16, for all that is in the world, he summarizes in three categories here. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. We take care of ourselves, don't we? And this is not of the Father, but is of the world. Let's go back to Proverbs 14. Remember, we're considering here wrong thoughts and this baggage that we're to be putting away. In Proverbs 14, Proverbs 14, verse 12, we have a reminder here about how mankind thinks, how we on our own, apart from God, view things in life and where that perspective leads. Proverbs 14, verse 12 simply says, there is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. This thought is repeated in chapter 16, verse 25. It seems right, doesn't it? Whatever mankind is doing, I can pursue whatever lifestyle I want. It seems right to me. I can treat people however I want. It seems right to me. I can live my life. I can eat and drink and imbibe in whatever vice I want because it seems right to me. But notice where it ends in verse 12 at the end. It ends in death, doesn't it? It doesn't take us beyond this existence. The way we think prior to God calling us is not the way God wants us to think. Now, granted, that way of thinking is twisted by Satan. He magnifies the worst of mankind's tendencies. But nonetheless, the way we think is a process divorced from God's way of living and thinking and acting. That's what we rehearse every Sabbath, every holy day, every day of our lives as we consider God's way of life, that we're to be changing the baggage, that we're to be shedding. Let's go to Galatians 6 next. Galatians 6 and verse 3. Considering this wrong thoughts again, Galatians 6 and verse 3, Paul writes, for if anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Now, what are we humanly? We're nothing. We're dust that God has breathed life into. We don't have an existence beyond this life. That's one simple way of looking at it. On the other hand, we're a lot, aren't we? God has given us life to become like him. But mankind has taken that life and done all kinds of things that doesn't honor God. We can even do that at times if we're not careful. To not think more highly of himself. So in verse 4, then he goes on to say, let each one examine his own work. Then he will have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. This is not a competition. My being in God's family is not predicated on as if I do better than you. That's one of the really wonderful things about this way of life. It's not a zero-sum game. But we're to examine ourselves so that we make sure that, in verse 3, we're not thinking more highly of ourselves than we are. Anything of value we have reflects God, doesn't it? That's what is eternal. But our thoughts can so easily deceive us. Look at how Adam and Eve was so easily deceived by Satan in the garden. They reasoned, didn't they? It looks good. I want to be a god. I want to live forever. Look at how David deceived himself in having Uriah killed so that he could have Bathsheba and believed that was okay. For more than 9 months after he put all that into motion, never gave it a second thought. Look at how the church at Corinth reasoned that a young man sexually involved with his stepmother was not morally wrong. And they saw it as acts of grace and mercy. Look at how easily we justify our own sin at times. We need to set aside wrong thoughts because that baggage of us is of no long-term value. It's something that has sat on the shelf that we think has value, and it's been years since we looked at it, and when we consider what it is, it's taking up valuable space. How much of this type of baggage did we have when God called us? A lot, depending on our lives. We managed to shed a lot of that, hopefully, as we've grown in God's calling, his understanding, But the question remains, how much of that baggage do we still have? Last verse for this point, let's go back to Romans 13. This summarizes our calling in a way. Romans 13, verse 11. Do this, knowing the time, that now it is high time to wake out of your sleep. You know, if nothing else comes out of this current crisis the world is facing, I pray that God's people, more than any other group of people, recognize that now is the time to awake out of sleep. It's a warning shot across the bow. We don't know how much time we have, but the reality shows us how quickly things can change. Who would have dreamed a month ago we would be like this? Virtually everything is shut down, and they're not talking about abating this anytime soon. That's just physically. What about spiritually? How much time do we have? Paul goes on here. He says, for now our salvation is nearer than we first believed. And there's all kinds of truth in that, isn't there? Doesn't matter when God called you. Doesn't matter when he placed his spirit in you. We're nearer now than when we first believed, no matter when that was. Verse 12, the night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness. Let us put on the armor of light to cast off that baggage and to put on what's going to carry us forward. Verse 13, let us walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and darkness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife or envy. If I can go back to John, not in following the lusts of the eyes and the flesh and of the world. Verse 14, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts. That baggage will not get us into God's kingdom. Point number two, then, is wrong actions. Wrong thoughts, wrong actions. Let's go back to Colossians, or go to Colossians. Colossians 3, and in verse 1. We're going to skip through several verses here up through 15. So Colossians 3, verse 1. If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is sitting at the right hand of God. That is, the things of this world should be far down the list of considering, rather, the things which are above. God's nature and character, what that means to us, how we internalize it, how we practice it, what that does in terms of what we think and how we behave. So verse 2 again, set your mind on the things above, not on the things of the earth, for you died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. We're a new creation, aren't we? At baptism, that old man died, pictured symbolically. We're to become a new life in Christ. Verse 4, when Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth. And these are some of the manifestations of that. Fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, covetousness. This is all worthless baggage. We can hold on to hurts for decades, it seems, at times. We can be willfully ignorant of things that hurt other people that we should change, or things that are even hurting us that we should no longer be a part of. Verse 8 again, but you now yourselves are to put off all these, anger and wrath and malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Don't lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds. This is human carnal nature. That's not, again, what's going to bring us to eternal life. Put on the new man who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him to reflect Christ. Verse 12 then, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved. See, we can still see our weaknesses and shortcomings, and I'm not saying we don't have those things. I'm not chiding us because we're not at a particular point or place. What I'm doing is reminding us that this is something that we should always be engaged in. And as God sees us now, as it says here at the beginning of verse 12, he sees us as holy, and he loves us. The protection that he gives us, the blessing of the knowledge of his way of life that he gives us, his spirit that helps us to accomplish these things. And so then as that, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do, not maybe, must. Think of what Christ did for us. Are we holding on to old hurts? Are we letting old history weigh us down? Are we for refusing to serve other people? Are we doing these various things? We need to stop and compare that against what Christ has done for us, what he does for us on a regular basis. And so verse 14, above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection, God's love. And let the peace of God rule in your hearts. No matter what is happening in the world right around us now, it will end. This is not going to go on forever. This doesn't fit into anything in terms of specifics of prophecy that we're aware of at this point. Doesn't mean that it's a precursor. There are all kinds of things that could come out of this that we don't see at this point. Times of crisis usually bring times of change, not always in a good way. But no matter what comes out of this, verse 15 again, let the peace of God rule in your hearts. What we see in the world, but also what we see in ourselves. We can be angry at ourselves at times. We can see those wrong actions. We can beat ourselves up. And there is value in acknowledging shortcomings, but we need to also have God's peace in us so that we can address it. Notice, to which you were also called in one body. We're unified, even if we're separated without voluntary choice. We're still one body. We need to be it. The longer we analyze what baggage we have, unfortunately, sometimes it seems that the load can grow, doesn't it? We annually go through the cleaning in our homes to de-leaven things. And in considering going through the house this year, it's like, why did I hold on to this again? Look at those shelves, look at the various clothes in your closet, look at the various things in your car, and it's like, why do I still have this? Well, there's some value to it. No, because I didn't use it, and the whole last year I had it. It's just taking up space. What do we do on a spiritual level that way? Old things we hold on to. But as we look at the physical things in our life that are in opposition to God's way of life, we also grow in understanding of the even more important spiritual aspects of God's law. So how do we deal with this conundrum? It can seemingly be a disconnect. The more we see and change, the more we see there is to change. This was Paul's lament in Romans 7, isn't it? We'll come to that in just a moment. But I think it's God's mercy, actually. If he told us everything we needed to change, everything we needed to address, every sin we needed to overcome at baptism, would we be here? Most people would probably throw up their hands and walk away. It's too much. It's overwhelming. And instead, God slowly peels back the layers. Week after week, month after month, year after year, we come to those things in God's mercy so that we have the ability to work with him to overcome them. But God is interested in consistency. What are we doing long term? As we consider our wrong thoughts and our wrong actions, we can see those things magnified as they should be in some ways. But on the other hand, we should also see the progress that he's doing in us. The degree of effort we're putting into it to remove that baggage of sin. Let's look at this in Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians 4 and verse 22. Paul here talking about a new man, breaking into the thought. He says, if indeed you have heard him, Christ, and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. Be renewed in the spirit of your mind, that we shed that baggage. We're energized to do better, different according to the world. to line up more with God, verse 24, and that you put on the new man, which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness, to put off that old man. Have you seen progress this year? Do you see strength that you had perhaps now that you didn't have in the past to weather things such as we're facing in the world now, but even strength to overcome things we see in our own lives? Let's go next to Romans chapter 6. Romans 6 and verse 13, Paul says here, "Do not present your members as instruments of unrighteousness to sin." One of the really sad realities in our modern era is that whenever we face crises such as this, the crisis we faced in 2008, the crisis we faced in 2011, the crisis we faced, you can go back in time and pick out these events, what has changed with mankind's behavior? Not much for the better. Look at where we are now as a culture compared to just 20 years ago. What has changed? Not for the good. God says, don't follow that. Don't present your members as instruments of unrighteousness to sin, but present yourselves to God as being alive from the dead, because we are. We read those verses a moment ago. Sin leads to death. The way we naturally, carnally think leads to death. God has given us life. We've not realized the full potential of that life yet because we're still physical. But he has given us life. He's offering us eternity. So see ourselves as God does, being alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness to God. Times of stress and difficulty do one of two things in our lives. We either rise to the challenge or we show our human weaknesses. What are we going to do with the things that we face in the world? Is it going to reinvigorate us, as we're reading here, to present ourselves as instruments of righteousness or instruments to sin? Notice verse 14, in case there's any doubt. For sin shall not have dominion over you, for you are not under the law, but under the grace. That is, under the penalty. God has paid that penalty through his Son. We don't have to worry about the penalty of death anymore. As long as we follow God's law, as long as we yield to him and become like him in character, as long as we follow his instruction, then we're under grace. He's going to help us accomplish this. Let's go across the page or so to Romans 7, verses 23 to 25. And I want to read this to you from the NIV. It's a little clearer. Romans 7, verse 23, "But I see another law at work in me, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin at work within me." This was the conundrum I referred to a moment ago of how Paul saw himself. This is roughly 25 years or so after his conversion on the way to Damascus. 25 years down the road, and he's saying, "I see these two things warring in my mind." Verse 24, "What a wretched man I am. Who will rescue me from this body that is subject to death?" Without realizing it, this is a question that everybody ponders at some point in their life. If only when they're approaching death. What value did this life have? What did I accomplish? What was the point? Verse 25, then Paul summarizes his thinking here. He says, "Thanks be to God, who delivers me through Jesus Christ our Lord." That is the answer to verse 24. Who will rescue me from this body that is subject to death? Christ has. We're going to rehearse that at Passover here in a few days to be reminded of that perfect, blameless, blemishlessness lamb that died in our place, that covered our sins, that rescued us from death. So then, considering what Christ has done, so then I myself in my mind am a slave to God's law. I don't get to determine what's right. God does. As giver of the life, as giver of the blessings that he's going to give us, as giver of the grace that he's blessed us with, I am a slave to God's law, but in my sinful nature, a slave of the law of sin. We still fall, don't we, from time to time. We still fail at times to live up to God's law. But that doesn't have to be where it ends. We can ask ourselves the question, who does our action serve? We read in 1 John 2, or earlier what we read, do our actions serve ourselves or do our actions serve God? Attending Sabbath services regularly, making time for personal Bible study, prayer, and so forth, they're all important because those things help us to grasp and see what God has in store for us so that we can see what baggage is holding us down. If you never keep the Sabbath, you're slave to that way of thinking, aren't you? I cannot take the time off. I cannot stop and listen to God. And yet, look at the blessings that flow from it. 1 Peter 2, verses 1 and 3, to sort of summarize, you can look that up a little later. It simply says, laying all those things aside. This is what we're talking about, of ditching this baggage. Wrong thoughts, wrong actions. But let's go here in Romans back a little bit to chapter 3. Romans 3 and verse 9. This is an interesting section here because Paul is pulling from several sections of the Old Testament, from Psalms, from Isaiah, from Ecclesiastes, and he's putting all these thoughts together here. So Romans 3 verse 9, he says, what then? Are we better than they? He's talking about, back up and earlier in chapter 3 here, the Jews that had the law and yet failed in understanding what God wanted them to do with it and how they erred. He says, are we better than they? He says, not at all, for we have previously charged both Jews and Greeks that they were all under sin. We know that. We've rehearsed that today. There are many other verses that pull that out as well. And so then he quotes from these various sections. Verse 10, there is none righteous, not one. There are none who understands. There are none who seeks after God. They have all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. There's none who does good. No, not one. Their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they have practiced deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips. The mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways. And the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before them. And we can point to the world and say, absolutely. But who is Paul writing to? He's not writing to the world. He's writing to the church at Rome. He's writing to us by extension. We need to consider these things in our own lives. And so then in verse 19, he says, now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God, that we consider if we have wrong thoughts, if we consider that we have wrong actions, and that we lay these things aside. Because we must be living up to the standard we profess. There's nothing most people hate worse than a hypocrite. We hate that in our politicians, and yet we get it all the time. We hate it in the celebrities when they say one thing and they do the opposite. We hate it in each other. Do we live up to the standards? Because the standards show us the baggage. Will people turn in light of what's happening in the world around us? Will they turn to God? Even if God would perform a miracle tomorrow and all of this would disappear, would they turn to God? I don't see it. I don't know that it would change their attitudes and their actions because they would have to address carnal nature and they don't have God's Spirit to help them with that. So then the last point, number 3, wrong beliefs. We read 1 John 2 earlier. He said, do not love the world. Don't love what the world believes. Don't follow those beliefs into actions. Don't let that become part of who we are. And the reason that Christ used the Pharisees so much as an example of what not to do is this. They were hypocrites, weren't they? They were great at the outward show, but he could see by their actions that they hadn't accepted what was the heart of God's law. They were holding on to their baggage, I'm good enough. That was the one that traveled on the train in Hawthorne's allegory. I don't have to change all this. I can carry it with me and still be in God's kingdom. But Christ admonished us to exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees. Now, they kept the law to the minutiae. So how do we exceed that righteousness? By internalizing it. For them, it was only show. It was only an outward expression. It didn't do anything to change them in terms of character. And that's what God is looking for. We need to look at what is in our character and keep only those things that Christ considers the weightier matters of the law, the things that lead us closer to God, to become more like Him and His Son. But let me bring this down a little bit closer to life today. What does the world value? One of the things I've appreciated in the last number of weeks, in spite of so much of the bad news that's going around, is that there's not a lot of talk about sports or movies or actors or what they're doing with their lives that are so important that we should stop and look at what they're doing. Reality shows, all of these things that the culture around us has valued, most of that has gone away, hasn't it? I suspect that whenever life returns to normal, whatever normal is going to be here in the near future, the world will return to all of those distractions. And God will not be important in their lives. Because the world doesn't value God as their creator. In fact, most of them don't even believe that He's their creator. The world doesn't value who He is, the values He has, the character that He has. They value that in others. But this is the lesson of the Garden of Eden, isn't it? We want to be our own gods. We want to do what we want to do. You have to do the right thing. So the world, again, will probably embrace the pagan and satanic beliefs and practices that are replete in the world around us. One of the necessary medical procedures that's considered vital still with all that's going on around us is abortion. It's not considered elective surgery. This is just one example. What do we believe? Is it what the world promotes? Or is it what God is revealing to those He has called to Him? We're coming up on His holy days, the first of this annual review that we'll do again. It's worth considering. Let's look at that in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. It seems that Paul was writing to the church at Corinth around this time of year, addressing issues that they had amongst themselves within the congregation there, and he draws this analogy of the unleavened bread. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 8, he says, "Therefore, let us keep the feast." See, he wasn't doing away with the law. He wasn't doing away with the observances that point us to God. Rather, he says, let's keep those days. But notice how. He says, not with the old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, not as we used to be, not as the world is around us, not compromising God's instruction, he says, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. We must have godly thoughts. We must have godly actions to replace wrong beliefs. You can't just give up a habit, can you? There's the old adage about nature abhorring a vacuum. Something will fill that. You try to give up a habit, you have to replace it with a better habit, not by doing nothing. This is what Paul's referring to here. We don't get rid of this baggage with old leaven, with old practices. We have to do it with unleavened bread, something new that involves the sincerity and truth of God's way of life. In fact, in Revelation 18 and verse 4, we're told in the end time especially, God pleads with His people to come out of Babylon. That's the system that's always been with mankind, especially since post-flood, but I suspect it was the same pre-flood. And it can be easy to point at things and look at prophecy and say, well, the beast power and this and that that's going to happen, and that form of Babylon that's going to exist before the return of Jesus Christ. But where is the biggest place of Babylon that we need to come out of? Right here. Our own Babylon that says to God, I know enough, I know better, this is not so bad, or whatever it is we use to justify ourselves, this baggage that we carry along, as I've been rehearsing with you today, this the wrong thoughts and the wrong actions and the wrong beliefs that we carry forward with us. That's as much a Babylon that we need to come out of as the world is around us. Let's go to Matthew 10 next. Purging our physical lives of baggage is challenging, isn't it? Cleaning out your house, even in the springtime. Do I get rid of this? Do I fix it? Do I sell it? Do I keep it? We have to go through those exercises of analyzing, don't we? Getting rid of spiritual baggage is even more important. Wrong actions, wrong thoughts, wrong beliefs. That's a lifelong challenge, isn't it? It's not once a year spring cleaning. That's not just when we come before the time of year of Passover and unleavened bread. It's a continual thing. Should be before us. Because in Matthew 10 and verse 22, we read here and it says, "And you will be hated by all for my name's sake." That's not very comforting at times, is it? Right now, we're not hated as a church. You might be hated at work, and you might have family members that don't like you very much because of what you believe and do. But as a whole, we haven't faced this type of persecution. But notice what he is offering. Because we live his way of life, and even if we're hated in this way, he says, "He that endures to the end will be saved." Is what God is offering of more value than what we can have in this life? That's the question. I'm preaching to the choir a bit here, aren't I? Those that have responded to God's calling say yes. What does it mean to have life as God has life? I don't know. We have glimpses of it. We can think of it in terms of physical things, never being tired, never being hungry, never being worn down and tired, having a perfect mind, memory, creative abilities that God has. But that's not our reality right now, is it? But he's offering it. Life eternal. He who endures to the end will be saved, will be like God in every fashion. We will not be him, but we will be in his family. And at times, enduring can be a passive act. I just need to get through this next week. Right? That's strength of will. There are times that that is fine, but the Bible is full of passages admonishing us to be active in our calling, not just passively enduring, actively engaged to feel and to strive and to work and to do. That's not sitting and waiting. We have a lot to do. That's why I said I believe much of this current COVID-19 business is as much to wake up God's church as it is the world. Probably more so. We have a lot of work to do. That's not meant to be overwhelming. You have a lot of work to do to finish a college degree, right? You have a lot of work to accomplish anything of life that's of value. To build a home, to accomplish things, to plan for retirement, whatever it happens to be. Those are all long-term things that we do regularly in life. This isn't any different. We're working towards the goal, and God is with us. In Hawthorne's tale, the two travelers who made the effort to get to the celestial city, to shed their baggage, and to go the path no matter what the challenges were, they succeeded. The pilgrim who sat and traveled by railroad and watched out the window as the scenery passed him, he made no effort to change. So consequently, he wasn't able to complete the journey. What he sought was outside of his grasp at the end. How about us? Here we are on this last Sabbath before we will take the Passover and subsequently before we will come before God on his days of unleavened bread. The spiritual baggage that we are to leave behind, are we considering that? I encourage each and every one of us to use the time that God has given us, whether it's on this Sabbath day, whether it's in our own study, whether it's when we're visiting or spending time with each other, when we're engaged in business, when we're gathered before God on his holy days, to think about our own journey. to think about the baggage of sin that we might unnecessarily carry through life, and that we let it weigh us down. Let us not let the baggage of sin deceiving us to thinking that we can take that with us into God's kingdom. Let's spend this upcoming week of unleavened bread considering the sins that we have in our lives and to work with God in our journey to remove it. Let's make our own personal journey to God's kingdom a profitable one.